Conciliums with Pete and Charlie.
I'm Pete.
I'm Charlie.
The unity of knowledge.
That and a whole bunch of caffeine is what's going to get us through this.
So Pete, is big data anything like big pharma?
No, but big pharma uses big data.
Oh.
Yeah, they take a lot of data on their tests of the effectiveness of a particular pharmaceutical compound. A lot of data comes out of what I do, molecular modeling of the ligand-receptor interaction. That sounds dirty.
Why does it sound dirty?
Ligand-receptor, the lock and the key. I don't know. Anything that's got some sort of insertion thing. Look, I'm going back to middle school here, and that's what I'm reaching for the jokes.
I just feel like you have to admit that it's dirty because it's something going into something, and then maybe we can move forward.
Yeah, that's it.
Maybe progressivism can
can rule the day.
Can come to this humor and
well, so what do you think of when you think of big data? Let's give our definitions of what we think big data is.
For me, and I am, I think I told you this right before we started recording. I'm stupid. I'm deeply ignorant when it comes to data as a commodity, data as a...
But you're one of the more progressive folks in the library advocating the use and analysis of data.
I don't know that I am. I don't know that I am.
Well, compared to a lot of the other librarians, you are.
You know, we haven't really had these discussions.
And now's a good time as any.
Certainly you and I have talked about my forward-looking or neophilic attitude towards... library stuff.
Ooh, neophilic, loving of the new.
Yeah, versus the...
The love that dare not speak its name.
Versus the
in certain areas of administration. Ooh, that's good.
Versus the conservative and, in some cases, reactionary, but mostly just conservative attitudes of some of my colleagues.
Mm-hmm.
But in
which
this case...
It can basically be summarized as, where'd all the books go?
maybe a little bit. But also, like, person-to-person service. That's a big part of the old school. You know,
okay.
The reference desk and
yes,
waiting
you
for someone
ask
to walk
someone.
Up and say, you know, where's Tom Petty from? Versus, well, let's look it up.
People don't really do that anymore, do they?
Well, this is what I'm saying. Like, it used to be that what Google does now used to be the realm of a lot of reference librarians.
True.
You know? How do I find out where Tom Petty is from or something like that? It's like, well, let's look in the Who's Who or the, you know, this encyclopedia or that encyclopedia. Anyway, but big data and using data and data, research data, curation and data repositories, data, which do you say?
I say data.
And is data singular or plural for you?
Data is plural. Datum is singular.
I find that I no longer care about that distinction.
I don't either. I try to be good and do it correctly, but if someone goes, it's the data,
yeah.
I tend to smack them. What Wham!
Let's see, what does the data say? What does the crowd say?
What do the data say?
Right.
It's correct. Yeah.
So what does the data say comes off my face and it comes out of my face, and I don't care.
Yeah,
okay. I don't mind. And I can be quite pedantic in my own way. For instance, decimate is a particular bugaboo of my... Oh, God, I hope that's not a racist thing I just said. What is bugaboo?
No, I'm
looking it up.
Yeah, I don't think... This is like my graduate advisor, who was a fine gentleman.
But a racist?
No, he was not a racist. he was a very pasty white Swiss guy who was married to a black woman originally from Jamaica. She lived in California. Very, very nice folks. But they probably stuck out like a sore thumb in pasty white Swiss society.
Okay, bugaboo is more like a boogeyman, so that's not what it is. It's
I know what you're thinking of.
what am I thinking of?
I'm not going to say it because it's racist.
Oh, the racist thing I'm thinking
yeah.
of. Oh, yeah, not yeah. that. I just realized that bugaboo was a thing that I've heard and thought, oh, that's a good word. I should use that. But then I don't know, because it's like the source of these words. Mm-hmm. You never know.
Yes, right. The etymology can trip you up.
Anyway, decimate. What does decimate mean?
Means to reduce to one-tenth the previous population.
By a tenth.
Oh, I thought it meant to one-tenth.
Mm.
I don't believe you. Look it up.
Okie doke. I hope I'm wrong.
Then decimate is not that. We decimated their ranks. What, you removed it by 10%? That's just attrition because people were tired of waiting in the Starbucks line.
Duke.
Decimate, blah, blah, to punish for decimation, removal of a tenth. I have been using that word incorrectly for years. To decimate one's rank is like, hey, well, one out of ten said I'm done with this
game. I mean, obviously the reality of every tenth soldier being killed by the nine previous, that's horrible.
Yeah, but so, but the actual act is not you were decimated by your enemy, you were decimated by your colleagues and just to teach you a lesson.
They were
that's
decimated
horrible.
When you actually mean devastated.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right, or decimate to in somehow some way imply a great destruction. It's right. Crap. It's not true. It's
okay.
It's all. It's like saying penultimate for
ultimate. Yeah, penultimate is the second from the end.
Right, and also to use that as a like the ultimate being awesome, and so penultimate is even more awesome. It's like yeah, that's like really getting it wrong. But decimate. Anyway,
no, but when I introduce the penultimate comedian, if I'm emceeing, I sometimes do that. That is awesome because if you want to, like, you know, get home early and you blow off the last guy, then that's better for you. Provided it was like a showcase thing where everyone did the same amount of time.
Now that sounded dirty.
What? Blow off the... Oh, sorry. I was watching Nikki Glaser's Not Safe last night. It was her last episode.
Do you have a crush on her?
I think she's very funny, and she was one of the first comedians who's really made it, whoever talked to me. So, yeah, if you want to call it that, yeah.
Yes. Let's get back to data.
To data.
You wanted to say something about Nikki Glaser being dirty? Because her show's pretty dirty.
No, her show's really dirty. I'm trying to figure it out. I made my wife watch it last night. It's funny. I think it could stand a little education.
Raunchy. Her show's raunchy
it
because
raunchy.
Of how explicit it is about stuff.
I do laugh, though. So, you know, it just admits I have a sick, twisted sense of humor, which I think most people who know me know that.
I mean, humor. Well, anyway. So, data, plural or singular, I don't care.
Okay.
If that's going to bother you, dear listener.
Very well, then. Let's move
back
on, shall we?
I'm going to get it wrong all the time.
Okay.
So, big data is the sense that we collect and process massive amounts of...
And that is what has changed in the last few decades.
Massive amounts of what? What was I about to say?
Of data.
I was going to say bullshit.
I mean, the fact that we have the internet, we have things electronically connected to each other, we have computers with huge amounts of storage on them.
Do you have a Fitbit on right now?
No, I do not have a Fitbit.
Do you have something that measures your actions?
Yes. It's called my wife. And she gives me constant biofeedback. Pick up your socks. Empty the dishwasher.
It seems so hacky.
By the way, honey, the stuff in the dishwasher now, I did load last night and did a rinse. It's not a wash. So, you know, you can proceed accordingly. Even though that'll be several weeks
ago.
Yeah,
almost undoubtedly.
I don't care.
I put this up 2 weeks
I don't
from
care.
Now.
Someone will say, well, at least he loads the dishwasher.
Big data.
Right. So because everything's networked now, our ability to collect and process data is a million times better than it was literally 30 or 40 years ago.
Even your social media is collecting data.
Right. You know, and being analyzed.
Because like a status update on Facebook, mm-hmm. that's data. That's it's metadata for you, essentially.
So in the old days, you were lucky to collect 30 data points and sit down with a pencil and analyze them.
And
now,
draw a line. I can fit a line as long as it bends in the middle.
You always have trillions of data points. So the question is, what can we get from this data? That's really what big data is trying to answer, in my opinion.
Yeah, and you can crunch these huge sets because of computing power.
Yeah, there is no longer an excuse to not do data-driven.
There is an excuse.
What, you're lazy?
What,
you're fat?
Why
you're
didn't
ugly?
Frankenstein think about this before he started meddling?
isn't that a work of fiction?
You and I once spoke in public about how the culture of assessment and the insistence upon measuring to manage can actually stifle quality ideas and actions.
Yes, I agree.
And I feel like there might be a little bit of that warning, that nervousness in big data.
I'm going to say no, as long as you understand that the first few times you do something, it's crap.
How many people understand that?
Not a lot of people understand that.
There is a lot of overnight success fantasy. right? Mm-hmm. And I have suffered it myself.
Right. Oh, here's my hypothesis. We'll test it. It will show great things.
Right.
Or, and it doesn't usually the first time.
That, you know, stuff that works should work right away.
Yeah.
People who are talented reveal that talent immediately. People who are not talented reveal that not talent immediately. All that kind of stuff. And so a big data set. We've done this for 6 months. We have all this data. We crunch it. It's bullshit. So we're going to move on and not do this thing. Mm-hmm. Could, in a way, be the exact opposite of good.
It can. But like I said, if you understand the first time you do
something.
You
got to stop doing that right into the mic. That was sorry. Even worse.
Okay. But I at least threw my head for that.
Did you turn your head and cough?
Yes, I did, but now? No one was touching another part of my body, thankfully. But the good news is that, so now, for example, we have all this data, and I'll take an example from the faculty meeting earlier this week in my department. So we're rearranging how we do teaching. We have some larger classes. We're concerned about this, and justifiably so. So, in fact, my school chair showed us a correlation between class size and teaching scores. And there was not a significant correlation. We were wondering, was there a very negative correlation, right? Is it saying with larger classes, students are less satisfied? And there wasn't. So that's a good use of big data to say, look, is there something immediate we should be concerned about? Now,
how many years of results was this?
Well, this was, I think, only over a couple of semesters since we've changed to larger classes. Right. But then we also looked at, research output and teaching scores, and there was no obvious correlation either. And
research output and teaching scores?
Yeah, right.
Scores?
So a lot of people think that the best teachers are the people that spend all their time teaching and not doing research, but in fact, there doesn't seem to be a correlation. Some of our very productive researchers are great teachers. And admittedly, these SIO scores are not perfect, right? There's a lot of scatter in those. There's a lot of, misinterpretation of those. But I think big data should be used to look for trends that are either good or bad and then act accordingly. And if you don't see a trend, and very often you don't, even with large amounts of data, then don't freak out. That's all I think he was saying. And that was a good use of big data.
So how does that become big data? And I mean this sincerely. I'm not arguing against it. I just want to unpack it. Mm-hmm. I mean, how many students and how many teachers?
Oh, yeah. So this technically wasn't big data, but this is data that we didn't
But why wasn't it big data?
It wasn't big data because it wasn't a large amount of data.
Large meaning?
Yeah, it was only 1,000 students, and it was averages, and we take it from the piece of software that collects this data.
And do you feel like big data really ought to be, millions of results?
But I guess there's two kinds of big data. There's even small amounts of data that previously we did not have access to because we didn't have surveys and the internet and the connectivity and the software. For example, you can now make yourself a little Google document that has a quiz that queries a whole bunch of people, and you can get data where you otherwise could not. So our ability to collect data, even small amounts of data, maybe it should be part of big data because it's more accessible data. Yeah, maybe it is more accessible data.
Which is more important, the amount of data that you can pull in or the crunching of it, the ability to crunch it? To make big data, to make this shift?
Well, it's definitely both.
Equally?
Yeah, I would say equally, right? It's also the quality of the data. The problem with data is that if you just put a little Google document out there that's a quiz, right, that you just don't know who's taken it.
Yeah, it's probably just people that you begged to take it.
It could be people that are taking it, people that are trying to mess with your data, people that take the survey more than once. And it's hard to protect against that. And that is why, for example, when they take data on medical trials, right, phase 1, 2, and 3 clinical trials for the FDA, they have to be very rigorous about finding, a control and experimental group that are representative of what you think you're trying to test, right? So, yeah, I mean, you may remember this from ER. In ER, there was always a study going on, and like, oh, let's see if we can get them in my study. That was a choice to be made. Maybe, for example, we have too many people of your demographic in that study already, then no good. You can't.
You say that people would be delighted by the demographic oddity of a person and say, hey, get in my study?
No, I mean, the NIH and the FDA have very distinct rules about that the cohort that you use, right? So, for example, you couldn't do a cohort that was all, you know, middle-aged white guys, unless you were trying to study heart disease in middle-aged white guys. But if you wanted to study heart disease in general, you want to get a representative sample, and they're very serious about that. Whereas if you're just taking data out on the internet, you don't know who's responding to this. You could have accidentally, your website could have been popularized among, pick a demographic, you know, ballet dancers, and you ask them about eating habits, and they're professional ballet dancers, and some of them, you know, have a little bulimia problem, and they're like, what? Carbohydrates, they're evil, you know. Whereas, you know, you get a bunch of sports fans who sit at...
What are you doing? This is terrible character work that you're doing right now.
Just work with me here. I'm just making up these demographics.
So I'm a big fan of Edward Tufte, who I found out recently is someone hated by many people. So, and
who is Edward Tufte?
He's a Yale professor, guy who worked for IBM and other folks, who does the guy who wrote The Visual Display of Quantitative Information.
Okay.
And did the big analysis of the Napoleon map.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, that's the first place I ever saw that. The map of Napoleon's march into Russia, where all of the information about that march, the size of the army.
Right, and the width of the line scales with troop strength. It's a very interesting graphic. I love it. I think it's great.
It had numbers to show what the time frame was.
Yeah,
but then
so
also
it had
the
time, location, and troop strength all in one graphic. That was very good.
So one of his concerns is how to deliver information that's been culled or distilled from data in a beautiful and effective way.
Mm-hmm.
And so part of me wonders... you know, has this always been the problem, right? Is being able to take data and make
it. It's more of a problem now because we have more data.
Yeah. Like the more data makes it even harder to find the story, right? And in a way, these massive amounts, massive amounts of data. I hate it, man.
Wait, no, this massive amount of data.
This Latin bullshit. You know, like the whole thing, like octopi.
Next up on BBC One, it's like, Latin bullshit.
Fuck that. You know, octopuses, right, is proper because we took the word octopus. We took the word.
Yeah.
Hey, there have been at least three moments in this podcast where you could drop in, like my cock, and get a really good joke out of it. You know.
Are you watching the new Andrew Dice Clay?
And if you're following along, one was about the thing about a bend in the middle, and the other one was about dark places, and the third I leave up to the listener. Okay. What is the sentence that describes what the data show, right? What is the... what is the story you can make?
That's tough to do. That is tough to do.
Right, and then when it's like, oh, we've got, you know, the heart rate of a million people, you know, over the course of 10 days. Like, what are you even trying to figure out when that's the data set that you've got going?
Right.
What do you think?
So that's very difficult, and that's what people that do this data analysis work on. I work on this. In fact, I teach this. I just gave a test the other day on... principal component analysis, which is kind of it's a very advanced topic where you take your original data and you rotate the data in its n dimensions into new linear combinations of those dimensions. And those linear combinations tell you something very important, but it's very hard to connect, you know, eigenvalues and eigenvectors to what the data says. So I try to use very simple examples.
Listening,
and
to
even
you
then
sometimes,
I'm failing.
It's
I'm
like
failing
I'm having
horribly.
A stroke. I don't know.
It is right because
stuff.
If I
linear,
say,
what,
"Oh,
what?
Here's the eigenvalues and eigenvectors," if you can read the matrix, that means something to you. But if you're a normal person, it doesn't. And to translate that into something else is difficult. For example, if you have three different dimensions that you're measuring, three different pieces of data, right? You know, it might be heart rate, respiration rate, and, you know, body mass index or something like that. And you're trying to correlate that to heart disease. What you may find is that if you put it through this particular analysis, what's important is not the three individually, but the sum of two of them or the difference of two of them. Right? And you could show that statistically. And if that's the case, you shouldn't try to correlate it with one or the other. You should correlate it with the sum or the difference of the others. And that's a weird mathematical thing that principal component analysis does. But to translate it into, oh, it should be the ratio of these, or it should be the difference, that means something to people. So,
wait, when you say that means something to people, as right. opposed to what and which people?
As opposed to the primary eigenvector that represents the maximum amount of variance in the data has two terms with the same sign and similar, you know, components.
You know, I feel like a
that
beating,
means nothing.
A beating is long overdue for you.
Rarely do I say this, but I concur.
So try to sum up what you just said. Try and tell me in a way that I would understand.
Oh, I failed miserably with my numerical methods class.
Explain fire to a fourth grader.
That's tough. That's called the flame challenge. Have you ever?
I remember it. Yes.
Oh, how to do that,
Pete? Man,
well, let me take the canonical example that I sometimes use. So I will use this idea of making a quick Google document to take surveys, and I will take a survey with typical dating service questions from my class. You know, do you like to read? Do you like long walks on the beach? Do you like dogs? Do you like cats? Do you like oatmeal cookies? You know, stuff like that.
Is the pause in the survey.
And one of the classic results we always get is that when you look at something called the covariance matrix, which is this weird mathematical thing that you can calculate, it tells you how coupled two independent variables are to each other, that the variance is high if when one tends to increase, the other one does as well, and it's negative when one increases, the other one goes in the opposite direction. One often assumes that people are either cat people or dog people. And do you know what I mean when I say that?
I do.
Yeah, so that's a common experience. Either you really love dogs or you really love cats. You would expect the covariance between those two to have opposite sign, that the more you like dogs, the less you like cats, and vice versa.
Well, that's just because of the narrative that dogs and cats living together, mass hysteria, yeah. That sort of thing. And that dog's chasing cats. I swear, right. I haven't seen a dog chase a cat.
No, I mean, this is an urban legend, right? An urban myth.
A rural myth.
But so people tend to believe it. But what we find in every single case when I do this for a class, that they're always positively correlated, which really means among the data that you took from these people, you either tend to be an animal lover or not. And that's different. And the point is, the first one's an urban legend. It probably was never true to begin with. But you can actually show with data something very simple that people can understand. That, oh, yes, this assumption appears to be wrong, at least in the data set that I'm sampling here.
A lot of times, though, people will respond to something like that with the equivalent of, well, that's just your class. Anyway, I know that dogs and cats don't get along, and that dog people aren't cat people, and cat people aren't dog people. So this is bullshit. Like, that's the...
It is.
That's
but
the response.
Data doesn't lie.
But people think the data lie, especially when we have the narrative of statistics being lies. Lies, damned lies, and
no,
statistics.
No, but that's not really true. Statistics, for lack of a better word, are good.
It's fine for you to say, no, that's not true to me while we're talking. But we know that there is a countervailing, that there is a narrative, a clear and consistent narrative.
It's countervailing in your face. Wham!
That the numbers are lies and that people manipulate data to show what they want.
But the reason people...
Wait. So then when you say, I have a million points of light here. Wait. Points of light? Points of...
Not gonna do it.
I have a million datum.
A million datum.
Why is it not datums? Yeah? Because of Latin? This is the point...
Datum sounds dirty.
This
yes.
is what I was trying to say about
datum,
octopus.
Datum, data, datu, data.
Octopus is an English word now. Right? We took it.
Who did we take it from? From whom did we take it?
From the
it?
Latin.
Oh, okay.
Or from whomever, right? Octo and puss, a fish okay. with eight faces, right? Because octo means eight and a puss is a puss. But that's...
Next up on BBC One, etymology with Charlie Bennett.
That's a Abbott and Costello joke.
That's good.
Octopus, plural octopi, under Latin rules, yes?
And James Bond, octopussy. Octopus A.
Under American rules, octopuses. Yes?
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that correct?
Okay.
What'd you say?
That would be under American with an M.
Yeah. So like, you know, when someone says stadia.
Okay.
For stadiums.
Sounds like some kind of infection that you need to use an ointment
for? Yeah, because of the Latin, right? Because you're using the Latin.
Okay, right.
Chlamydia, chlamydiae. I don't know, but like, what do you use?
Chlamydium.
Auditoria? It's like, shut up. Put the S on the
end.
Is
there a point here? Were you going to make a point about
this? I'm just saying, you know, don't, I mean, Latin is a dead language. Why follow the rules of Latin? Okay, so a million points of data.
Okay.
And then you say, and this is what it says, what a person, as you say, a regular person, mm-hmm. right? Someone who doesn't have a PhD in something, someone who has not done science or engineering as a profession, someone who, let's be honest, is just, you know, trying to enjoy their life and get through the day and mm-hmm. have a nice time and enjoy whatever it is that's at home for them, right?
Right.
It just doesn't want to be bothered with your cohort and your eigenfactor value bullshit quantum leap of whatever, right?
And they, now, math insults.
What can they say? They can say a million data points. What? It doesn't even mean anything. I can't even conceive a million data points. People can make numbers say anything they want. I don't believe you. I distrust you. I know what's right. There's
actually,
dog people
no,
and cat people.
No, we can't make numbers say anything we want.
Explain that.
I mean, the numbers are the numbers. I mean, we can make things that paint it in a better or a poorer light, but... So here's what I will say to the normal person, of which you are clearly not one.
Normal person, that's right. That's what you said.
And actually, I shared this with my physician.
Shouldn't that be normal per se?
Certainly. And that is that you see one study. Don't always believe the first study. The first study may be a small sample size. It may be not the right representative demographic.
It may be a cash grab.
It could just be a weird fluke. One study means nothing, but as you see more and more studies that show the same trend based on statistical analysis, and you achieve, dare I say it, consilience.
Oh, shit. you're trusting the aggregate.
Yeah, I am trusting the aggregate. But the more different analyses that we can do, the more we'll aggregate this data. And here's the ironic part. The ironic part is the people that are like, well, no, I know that dogs and cats don't get along.
Why do you got to give them that accent?
I don't know. That was really insulting to everyone from the South.
Give them the teeth one. I know that there are dog people and cat people.
Okay. You sound like Peter Griffin's father-in-law from Family Guy.
Why is everything Family Guy,
Peter? No, wait. What's his name?
Why,
Mr. Peter
Why
Schmidt.
Is everything Family Guy? Why?
It just
why?
Is.
Why is it? Why is it?
Because.
Why? Why?
Because.
You got to stop. You got to stop with the Family Guy.
Ironically.
Never seen that show in my life.
Those people who just claim that, well, this is the way it is, they are using something that psychologists call System 1, and that is this intuitive, subconscious kind of like, I just believe what I believe, and they don't want to look at the data. And ironically, what the data has shown in psychology studies, and I mean hundreds, if not thousands of psychology studies that, yes, no matter how smart you are, you know, we can screw with your choices simply by, you know, showing you a picture of something. And we all use that System 1 because cognitively we are lazy. Just anything. So, for example, if I fill your environment with pictures of money or dollars, you will tend to be more selfish. But you will also tend to be, I'm trying to think, there was a good side of that too, more independent.
What?
And study
you
after
say
study.
Pictures of money?
Yeah. So images of money or any reference to money, right? Any sort of, what do they call it?
God money.
No, I'm trying to think. Priming. They can prime you. Advertisers do it all the time. So that's what I'm saying. Even I, you know, for example, they found that if you were voting on a bill, if you're voting on some referendum to help schools, you're more likely to vote for that referendum when your polling place is a school. And they've done this time and time again.
That's horrifying.
Even smart people, hopefully like us, can be primed and manipulated by that sort of thing. So the people that says, I don't believe the data, I believe what I believe, they're falling prey to this weird cognitive issue that the data has shown exists in everyone, no matter how smart you are. We should talk about a book called Thinking Fast and Slow.
You've talked about that before.
It summarizes.
Why are you compelled by that?
Because I'm listening to it in my car, and I listened to some more of it today. So it's fresh in my mind. So actually, when something's fresh in your mind, that image, you're more likely to be dominated by that thought as well.
And the thing that it sort of explains everything, oh, this connects this and that.
No, it doesn't explain everything, but it explains some of why we make choices.
Don't fall under System 1. Don't make a mistake, Pete, and then Stick with it.
Ironically, they talk about this issue of cognitive ease, that if you're mellow, you're more likely to fall into using your intuitive system one to make decisions. Whereas if you're uptight, you're worried about something, you're like, oh, I don't trust this. Then you'll think. Then you'll use your higher brain function. So actually, ironically.
Did you just call anxiety
a genius agent? Yes. No, that's exactly what they called it. So ironically, if you're a little nervous for the test. No, I didn't call it that. Well, they didn't use those words, but that's a very apt summary. Anxiety is a genius agent.
This is why pop makes you stupid. It doesn't actually make you stupid. It just makes you kind of cool.
It just makes you
not
give a crap.
Oh, whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
Fine.
So.
You know what? I have to admit that these days I'm much more on the side of stupid and happy.
But you're not 100% stupid and happy, right?
Oh, I'm quite stupid. This is Consilience with Pete and Charlie, a podcast about the intersection of science and the humanities.
The unity of knowledge. I always like to say that part.
You can find us on Facebook, you can subscribe to us on iTunes, and you can always get in touch with me or Pete if you look on Twitter and other social media.
And can't you also find us on Tumblr at peteandcharlie.tumblr.com?
Thank you.